It's my great pleasure to be here to tell you a little bit about radio sources and how that may matter or affect the SE surveys. These are the main collaborators for the projects that I'm going to present today. So the first, let me just show you some pretty pictures of radio galaxies. I want to draw your attention to the linear scale of these guys. So this is Fornax A, 400 kiloparsecs, and Cygnus A, Virgo A, and 3C75, that's 700 kiloparsecs. So the point I want to make is that radio galaxies can be very big. They can well affect their immediate surroundings, and they can be very powerful. And this has prompted people to think that the feedback from the AGN phase, the radio loud AGN phase, may be a very important process to make the very massive galaxies. For example, in this color stellar mass diagram of the semi-analytic model of Crotton et al., without the AGN feedback, the most massive galaxies are blue, and they are more massive than what's observed in the universe. Only when the AGN feedback is turned on, the most massive galaxies are red, as observed in the local universe. And when you project all the points to this axis, this essentially becomes the luminosity function. And so the result is shown here. So without the feedback, you have this population of extremely bright, massive galaxies. And with some feedback, you can match your luminosity function to the observed one. Another motivation to study radio galaxies that's more relevant to this audience is that the SE surveys are happening. And we know SE surveys hold great promise to probe cosmology as well as cluster physics. But if there's anything lying or projected along the line of sight to cluster field that will also add some signal, then it will distort the SE signature, and that may bias your cluster selection and even the cosmological parameter estimation. And the potential contaminants are that we heard over and over are radio sources and dusty galaxies. And so it's very critical that we know how they are related to the halos, and such that we can make corrections in the power spectrum estimation and the cosmological parameter inference. And in this talk, I will just focus on the radio source part, and I will present three projects. First is a statistical study of some of the fundamental properties of radio galaxies in the nearby universe, including their luminosity function and the clustering properties. I will then show a study that tries to characterize the spectral energy distribution of radio galaxies that's known to be members of clusters. And then I'll conclude by this phenomenological model of powerful radio sources that Nilima just mentioned. Hopefully, with this attempt, we can improve our knowledge on the radio sources and help our understanding or characterization in the cluster selection function of SE surveys. So first, this is a statistical study of radio galaxies at redshift less than 0.3. So basically, we took the Sloan BR6 main galaxy sample down to absolute magnitude of minus 20.5, which is about M star, the characteristic magnitude in the luminosity function. This sample contains more than 220, or about 220,000 galaxies. And then we cross-match this sample with two main surveys at 1.4 gigahertz, namely NBSS and FIRST. And in so doing, we generated the largest radio galaxy sample in the local universe to date. And that contains more than 10,000 radio galaxies, stronger than 3-minute jet skis. And the important improvements of our study over previous attempts include that because of the sample size and the way that we select the galaxy sample, we can construct several volume-limited subsamples that will make the estimation of the luminosity function and clustering easier. And because this is from the main sample, 90% of the radio galaxies have measured redshift. And the other 10%, we assume that its closest neighbor has the same redshift as the radio galaxies. This is due to a fiber collision problem in Sloan. And then we visually inspect all the radio galaxies to ensure that matches are real to a human being, not just to an automatic pipeline. And in so doing, we also typed the morphological information of these radio galaxies. So we roughly separated them into compact or extended. And for extended sources, whether they are FR1 or FR2, et cetera. And the large sample also enables us to measure the correlation functions to high signal to noise, which then allows us to do a HOD modeling, the halo occupation distribution modeling, that will help us understand the relationship between radio galaxies and their host halos. So this shows the whole sample in the plane of 1.4 gigahertz radio luminosity and the absolute magnitude in R band. So that's 10,000 radio galaxies. And in this talk, I will mention two volume-limited subsamples. First one is limited to -20.5, and that will also induce, so the upper limit in redshift also induce a limit in the radio flux that that we are complete and volume-limited. So the galaxies above this line and to the left of this line is in this volume-limited subsample. And a brighter subsample that's limited to this -21.5 R-band magnitude is defined by sources lying in this region. And so in this luminosity plane, if you collapse all the points onto either of the axes, then you basically constructed the luminosity function in either the optical or radio. So let me just show you the optical luminosity function. The blue points are the luminosity function for our main galaxy sample. So that's irrespective of their radio fluxes. And the red points are the radio loud galaxies. In this case, that's the -20.5 sample. So it goes to this limit. And so you can see that the fraction of galaxies in each magnitude bin that's radio loud is not constant. And if you sum up all the galaxies down to this limit and divide by the sum of all the galaxies, you find that about 2% of the galaxies more luminous than M star in the local universe have radio power stronger than this 10 to 23 watt per hertz, which is about the division line between the star-forming galaxies and the radio-loud AGNs. So the bottom line is about 2% of the galaxies are radio AGNs. Okay. And then we studied the projected correlation function. Again, the book. Yes?
So you think massive galaxies are less likely to be radio loud? Is that true? Or
yeah. Well,
okay, so the way around. Yes. Okay, sorry. Yeah. Right. So are more likely to be radio.
Yes. Yes.
But that's a function of your radio power cut as well, right?
Right. Yes.
I don't have a plot to show that, but yes, it's a function of both optical and radio luminosities.
Okay,
so we next look at the correlation function. The blue points are, again, all the galaxies. The red ones are radio loud, and this is for the minus 21.5 subsample. And so both the radio and optic, all the galaxies and radio galaxies, they are selected according to the same optical luminosity limit or galaxy mass, effectively. And we see that the radio galaxies are more strongly clustered. And you may ask that maybe this is because the radio galaxies, they are preferentially more redder than the overall galaxy population. But we checked, when we further divide this into, a color selected sample, the radio galaxies are still more strongly clustered. And if we look at a very luminous beam in optical, the statistics is not good, but there is still a hint that the very luminous radio galaxies are still strongly clustered, more strongly clustered than the than radio quiet galaxies. When we do the matching, we take into account, we basically look at NVSS and first sources around 3 to 4 augmented around each Sloan galaxy, so that we are sure that all the components are associated with the galaxy. But I guess this is not your question.
Well, my question, most of the excess seems to be on very small separations.
Right.
So I was just worried that if all the galaxies came in pairs that were 0.1 and H inverse megaparsecs across, that might give you some funny signal. But it might not if you do the matching with Sloan, so I don't have a sense. I'm just wondering if that might be a problem.
You're talking about multiple, jets?
Yeah, no components for the radio source. Well, that's something to worry about.
I couldn't quantify it, but I think the effect should be small.
Measurements from NVSS?
Yes, so Chris Blake measured the angle correlation function, which I didn't do, but I think I will show you next the HOD calculation, and then from that I can compute the corresponding angle correlation function. That's a good thing to do. But
we are limited to very local galaxies here, whereas when you look at angle correlation function, it's projected along the line of sight. So I'm not sure how useful that comparison will be. But I think this is consistent with the Magliocchetti result when they used 2DF to do the correlation function.
This is, in a sense, though, a measurement of what's happening in 3D space, not on projection on the sky. Is there? You'll see at a given flux level, you'll see much more distant sources in the radio.
Right, but we are volume limited, so.
Okay, so next I will use the correlation function that we just measured. So this is for the two volume limited subsamples. We use this data to constrain the HOD parameters. And for those who do not really know HOD is, this is a quick introduction. So basically, by specifying the relationship such as the number of objects in a halo of mass m, and the way these objects are distributed within the halos, you can analytically calculate the power spectrum in this one halo and two halo terms. So this one halo term tells you what's the power coming from galaxies that belongs to the same halo, and the two halo term tells you the correlation between galaxies located in different halos. So the thing you need is this theoretical mass function of the halo and the first and second moment of this number mass relation.
and then the spatial distribution of your objects within halos. And so from this, you can calculate the power spectrum, and the Fourier transform of that is the correlation function, which is what we use to constrain the model. So for the number mass relation, we separate the radio galaxies into the central and satellite components, and saying that the central radio galaxies is one whenever the halo is more massive than a certain limiting mass. And the satellite is just following a power law with slope of alpha. And so these are the fit to the observed correlation function. And we find that the HOD modeling suggests that limiting mass n min is greater than 10 to the 13. So that shows that the radio galaxies are hosted by group scale or more massive halos. And we also find a very weak halo mass dependence. So this alpha parameter is close to zero. It's like 0.1, 0.2 or so. Yes?
Satellite component at all?
I think that's a fair statement. Most of the galaxies are just central, and they really sit in the center of the halo.
I will show you some results. So
instead of using a large-scale clustering of the galaxies to infer the halo radio galaxy relationship, we can, since we have a large sample, we can just look at the radio galaxies that's within known clusters. So I took the galaxy clusters from the ROSAT All Sky Survey, NORES and REFLEX. There are about 130 of them in the Sloan DR6 region. And I just count the galaxies more luminous than minus 20.5 in these 130 clusters. And I find that the number of galaxies, irrespective of their radio luminosity, as a function of M200, is goes as about mass to 0.8 power, which is consistent with previous findings. And the number of radio galaxies as a function of halo mass is shown as the red points. For those halos without, or clusters without a radio galaxy, they are plotted here. And so most of the halos have one, two, or three radio galaxies. And for those halos that have whose BCGs are radio loud, they are shown as the star, green star here. Okay, so just some statistics. Out of the 1,400 galaxies that belong to these clusters, about 6% are radio loud. And about 25% of the BCGs in these clusters are radio loud. And about 4% of non-BCG galaxies are radio loud. So all these numbers, so this shows that the BCGs being centrally located are very likely to be radio loud. And you can compare these figures to the overall radio loud fraction, which is 2%. So that suggests that the cluster environment promotes the radio AGN activity. I can also look at the spatial distribution of radio sources within these halos. So so this is surface density arbitrarily normalized as a function of R over R200, the scaled radius. And the red points show the spatial distribution of radio galaxies. And you can compare that to the blue points, which is for all the galaxies. If I were to fit an NFW profile to these two distributions, I find that galaxies are characterized by a concentration 4 model, but radio galaxies are basically a power law or concentration greater than 60 or so. So they are just at the center. Okay. And as a simple exercise to see what's the difference. Yeah.
So there is one galaxy at the center, or there are multiple galaxies at the center?
Well,
most of the time it will be one galaxy, and in only a few cases there will be more than one. But I didn't really characterize where these actual guys are. Okay, I guess I have to speed up. Well, so we did a comparison of the radio loud and radio quiet galaxies such that they are selected to have the same optical luminosity, apparent magnitude, and redshift, and just see how many neighbors do they have on average. And we find that the radio loud galaxies have excess of neighbors within 0.5 megaparsec compared to the radio quiet ones. So that's another indication that they are located in dense environments and they may have more interactions. So sorry, I have to speed up and jump to the second.
There's no one after you, so people are okay. Longer. So I think, take your time.
Okay.
We can talk right up until the end. So 20 more minutes.
Well, maybe
people are more interested in the museum or something. But okay, thanks. So
I think that speaking people are saying a lot of points, or yes. That must be why you're so interested.
Okay.
I mean, it's something about you as
well. I thought you put me in the session for a reason.
Yeah, I suppose.
Okay, so if there are no more questions about this, then I'll move on to the second project that I want to present, which is the SED of the radio sources in nearby clusters. So the motivation is that we know a lot about radio galaxies from observations done at low frequencies, say below 10 gigahertz. But SED surveys are actually typically carried out at much higher frequencies, except for like AMI, which is at 15 gigahertz. So it's critical to know their spectral energy distribution or their spectral shape, and so that we can apply the knowledge that we gain at low frequencies to higher frequencies. And so Bolton et al. In 2004, they actually did something in this direction. So they took the 9C sources, which were selected at 15 gigahertz, and they followed them up at 1.4, 5, 22, and 43 gigahertz to see what their spectral energy distribution is like, which is shown here. So this shows 25 radio sources in their sample, and this is from 1 gigahertz to 10 gigahertz, and this is radio flux. So you see that they are falling. I mean, some of them are falling, but some of them are just flat. But this may, you have to know that these sources are selected at 15 gigahertz. So it's not surprising that they are biased to flat spectrum sources. But these sources are not restricted to cluster environments, and they most of them do not have redshift info. So we don't know the rest frame SED. And then recent improvement comes from Kobo et al., where they studied sources projected within cluster fields, but they only look at 1.4 and 28.5 gigahertz. So if the SED is complex, then just from two frequencies, it's really difficult to say what their overall SID is. And besides, they do not have firm cluster membership info for this sample.
Yes. Sure. And so we try to combine the advantages of these two studies by looking at a large sample of radio galaxies in about 100 nearby clusters and follow them up at four other frequencies. So the result is presented in this paper, and I'll briefly describe the result here. And so Leno and Owen, they did an extensive survey at 1.4 gigahertz over 400 Abel clusters, and they basically measure all the redshift for sources stronger than 10 Minujanskis.
And so we use their source catalog, selected the confirmed members, and followed them up with VOA at 5, 8, 22, and 43 gigahertz, which I will also call them C, X, K, and Q bands. They were observed nearly simultaneously, and the typical flux, I mean, noise is about 1 millijanskis. For extended sources, it's kind of difficult to measure the spectral energy, spectral index, because at high frequencies, some of the fluxes will be resolved out. So we actually downgraded the resolution at 43 gigahertz to match the resolution at 22, which we called tapering. So for better measurements of the spectral index at the highest frequencies, but we didn't do anything for the lower frequency indices. So I'll please be cautious about that. And so in the end, we have 136 galaxies detected in at least one band. So we started with 139 galaxies. Three of them do not show up in any of our frequencies. And out of this, about 110 galaxies, which have 140 components, are detected in three or all bands. So that allows us to characterize their spectral energy distribution. 86 of all these components have steep spectra at the lowest frequencies, like between 5 and 8. And by steep, I mean alpha less than minus 0.5, in a convention that flux goes as new to alpha. And 57 sources, they are very compact, or the cores of a more extended structure. And for this, we detected them in all frequencies. So we can look at this color-color diagram in the radio. So this shows the spectral index in C and in 5 and 8 gigahertz. And this is the index at 22 and 43 gigahertz. So the distribution of the points on this line actually tells you what's their spectral shape. So for those guys living in this quadrant, they have steep falling spectra. And opposite happens for those in this quadrant. And for this region, there's the sources actually show some upturn in flux beyond 8 gigahertz. And this is source for sources peaking at about 10 or less gigahertz. So some of these sources are shown here. So they have falling spectra below 10 gigahertz and then kind of flattened out at higher frequencies. So if you just infer the 43 gigahertz from lower frequency observations, you will be biased low. Okay, so the real measurement actually give you a flux density that's about 2 times higher than what you will get based on lower frequency observations. So this just echoes the finding of Bolton et al, such that the spectral shape is complex.
Is that only the sources that you saw in all frequencies for that statement's true?
Well, we need them to have at least 3 frequencies. So ideally, we should follow them up at all frequencies. I mean, we should look at them.
But that factor of 2, so is that only for the ones that you actually saw at 43 gigahertz? I mean, is there some?
Yes. But those are also more likely to be seen at higher frequencies.
I think this for the entire sample versus the ones that are essentially you're doing a selection of 43.
Yes, I guess. Yeah.
So that's very interesting. So cooling of electrons would actually tend to move you in the lower right corner of this plot. So this suggests that there's a second component, and that the flatness of this component suggests that it has to be very compact. Do you see actually any morphological correlation of the flatness of the spectral index to the morphology?
No, I didn't look at them. We we just use a very crude eyeball classification, saying that these are all compact and these are all. But for those sources shown here, they are all compact. So we didn't further look into whether how compact they are and see if there is any correlation with their spectral index. But I think that's an interesting thing.
So do you have a sense, how big are the typical error bars on the spectral indices in that
plot? Oh, right. So that's that
will be based on our flux measurement uncertainties. Sorry, I couldn't give you a number now. But
I didn't show you an error bar here.
There are errors. It is the case for that whatever size the error bars are, the line for sources that turn up is diagonal to the thing. And I don't know, 80% of the points are above the line.
Okay, let me move on. And so this is the spectral energy,
spectral index distribution at this three frequency band. And the solid histogram is for core point-like sources, whereas the dashed histogram shows the SID for all sources. And I want to emphasize that for the lower two panels, this may be lower limits. So they may shift slightly toward more positive values. But the mean of the high frequency spectral index distribution is about minus 0.6. Okay, and we also look at these two figures to see if there's any correlation between the the spectral index with respect to the host cluster or galaxy properties. So for example, we look at the correlation scatter plot with radio power, optical color, and the optical luminosity of the host galaxies. We didn't see any obvious correlation for 5 to 8 and 22 to 43 indexes. And also look at the correlation or scatter with the M200 of the host halo and their position in the halo and the redshift. So no correlation. That's the final message. And we extend this study to high redshift so that we may be able to see some evolution. Okay. Yes.
How many sources do you get in this mid intermediate Z sample?
It's very small because it takes very long time to integrate at these higher frequencies. So I think we have about 15 sources. So that's hardly enough to make a statistical study, but that's the first step.
Okay, so
that result will be presented by this paper led by Bruce. Okay, in the last few minutes, I will just go over again the model that Nilima already presented. So we know that in the literature, there are already many studies for the radio source evolution, such as Condon 84 and Dunlop and Peacock or Tovalapi. So why do we want a new model? The basic goals is that we want to try to constrain the cosmological evolution of radio sources within the WMAP cosmology and also provide an easy way to create realistic mock catalogs of radio loud agents for SZ experiment or whoever interested in this kind of things. The features of the model is that the relationship between the halos and the radio sources are built in. And the halos are populated with sources in a Monte Carlo fashion. So every realization will be slightly different, but the overall trend is the same. And this model can fit source counts from 0.15 to 150 gigahertz, that's three orders of magnitude, and as well as radio luminosity functions out to redshift 2, given the limited beta. The caveat is that, as Nilima already referred to, we will not have sources beyond redshift 3, and we know some of the strongest sources at redshift greater than 4. So this will bias our inferred evolution. I also didn't include star-forming galaxies because they are not really relevant for the, I mean, for my purpose. And there's no physics in this model. It's just phenomenological. I couldn't tell you why they have to evolve this way. I mean, I can tell you some ideas, but I really couldn't
tell you from the first principle. That's why.
So the relative dependence is just based on fitting to the Nasty function.
Right.
Okay.
So we basically populate the halos under some prescriptions, such as the number of radio galaxies as a function of mass and their redshift evolution, the way radio galaxies are populated, are located in the halos that we took from the first study that I showed, and their spectral shape. So this, the halo catalog and the SZ are from Pobodian heat track, and I only consider two classes of radio lot AGNs, which are the FR1 sources, and I assume they have mild cosmological evolution, and the stronger FR2 sources. So you see they have a core and extended lobes at the outskirts. And we model the SED of the core and lobe components differently. We assume the lobes, because they are old, so they just fold steeply. And for the core, we consider a third order polynomial because we cover a huge range in frequency. Okay. So Nilima already showed this figure. And so the basic idea is that I draw the radial luminosity from an assumed luminosity distribution so that the luminosity function at the local universe can be reproduced. I did that by tuning the HOD parameters. And then I adjust the density evolution so that the source count at 151 megahertz can be reproduced. So the red points are the model and the blue points are the data. Yes? Yes, that's one thing that I skipped. But because this modeling is in spirit similar to Wellman et al. In Oxford. So we employ this relativistic beaming model, and that will adjust the core to lobe flux ratio. And so
that's how you
decide. Yes, I think the underlying assumption is that at 151 megahertz, you are seeing the lobes are dominating. Okay, so we adjust the evolution so that the overall shape of and the amplitude of the source count can be fit, because overall the source count is basically just the luminosity function stacked in redshift space. And then we adjust the SED so that we can reproduce other observations. So very quickly, I'll show you the luminosity function evolution at 4 frequencies. This is 0.15, 2.7, 5, and 20 gigahertz. The model are the black points. Sorry, I changed the color. And this panel is at redshift 0. This is at redshift 1. And the top panel is at redshift 2. So I think overall apparently at high redshift, there's not much data. But overall, the evolution, I think, can be justified. And then this is the source count below 33 gigahertz, so from 0.15, 0.6, 1.4, up to 33. The red points are the model. All other colored points are existing data. And at higher frequencies, these are WMAP beta. And again, this is the DeSoti model. So it's not interesting to compare to another model, but there is some agreement. And this is from Akbar. So I would say that source count reproduces the data where available reasonably well. And this is the power spectrum figure that Nilima just showed.
And so just tell you the best fit parameters. Sorry, this I want to caution that they may be degenerate. And they may be limited by the Halo catalog because we only go to ratio of 3 and we are only complete to few times 10 to 12. But I don't, I think this is not as a serious problem for radio sources as for infrared sources. And so for FR2, we infer a very shallow mass dependence and about 200 times increase in the comoving density peaking at ratio of 3. But for FR1s, for the weaker sources, we basically do not have much handle on it. And so this is really irrelevant. Okay, I'm done. So this is the last slide, which is just, okay. So this figure shows the correlation between the AGN, total AGN fluxes in a halo, sorry, not correlation, a scatter plot between this total AGN flux and the SE flux. For halos selected in a thin redshift shell between redshift 0.9 and 1 in a patch of sky that's about 1200 square degrees wide. So there is not much correlation here, but my interest is to see how many of the halos will be affected by these radio sources. So this red line shows the relationship that our flux of AGN is about 20% of the SE flux. So everything above this line will be, to some degree, affected by the AGNs. So basically, I further quantify this contamination fraction by calculating the fraction of sources that's above this line compared to the overall population as a function of halo mass at different redshifts. So for a low redshift bin, 0.4 to 0.8, the contamination is shown as the red points. So that's very low, 2% or so, even at this low mass regime. Only at very high redshifts beyond 1, you started to have more contamination. So this is due to the combination of that I have very, very strong cosmological evolution of radio sources beyond redshift 1. And
Cartridge?
Yes.
You can only pick out 15 sources when you go to redshift 0.6.
Yes.
Same question. And so it's a little surprising that, except for this evolution that you derived right from the
No, I mean, if you look at the source count, I think you will find that for the ones that dominate at the bright end, they are actually at high ratios.
So, okay, I agree.
Yes. Right, so that's it. This is what I want to say. Thank you very much for your attention.
Can you go back one slide?
Yes.
I'm trying to reconcile the plot with the bullet point immediately under it.
Uh-huh.
And just explain that.
Sorry? Which plot?
Well, the plot that shows contamination fractions ranging from 2%.
Yes. Okay. So very naively, this is basically correlated with mass, right? And this is only looking at a thin redshift shell. So you can just bin these points in different fluxes bins, and then just see how many sources are above and within this whole bin. And that's basically what I did.
Those in 1260 square degrees.
Yes, so I mean, this is for halos within this redshift range. And I'm just saying I consider all halos, halos in these three redshift bins.
Sorry. The criteria for contamination is 20% more than flux. Right. That's what it means. Right. Okay. And that's
all
at
right.
That's at what frequency?
148. Yes. I should say that.
So you can
loss control.
Sorry, it's
no, go ahead.
So I mean principle with ACT, so you know all the
specifics of that, so you should be able to say that how much of this you can clean based on frequency dependence, right?
Right now we are basically exclusively working at 148 gigahertz, so we couldn't really use the spectral, higher frequency data to infer. But what we can do is just mask out all the. Sorry, this is not replying your question. So what's your question?
Can you clean them
using multi frequency?
Well, I think given this, if this is true, and given the low sigma 8, this will not be many clusters, and we can just follow them up.
You can just
follow them up?
Follow them up?
If I can apply for many telescope time. But I think we can for the power spectrum, I think we can use the source model and take that into account to estimate the cosmological parameters. Only when you want to do measure the mass function of the clusters, there will be a more serious problem. But about the mass limits of the SPD or ACT surveys, I think this is really not a strong issue.
Okay.
This is much lower masses.
But I mean, to avoid bias, though, there will have to be some sort of, whether it's a follow-up at 90 gigahertz or an internal different frequency measurement, something will have to be done to understand what your contamination is, right?
Yes, I totally agree.
But do you have a sense of, I guess it's not so much error bars on that plot, but if you were allowed to turn knobs a little bit more, how high do you think you could get that number?
Okay. So yes, as I said, this is just one realization. What I can do is run this 20 times and then have a distribution of the points, and that should give us the sense of how worse things can go.
So do you think there's any way to get it above 10%? Down at 10 to the 14.4 or something? Or I better not tell any number.
Well, another thing is this relies on the model of P and Paul. So, this is dividing by the NZ signal, which may also be uncertain in the simulations. But
that comes in, you have to change that by a lot to get what Gil's asking. I think Gil's asking really is there an upper limit that could drive this to a 10%, a significant fraction at sort of mass limits we're talking about practically for acting SPT.
Right, yes, I know. Right now, other than running this many times, I don't have a good sense of it. Different redshift evolution will certainly affect this. So,
but it's already pretty reasonably strong evolution, right? That factor of 200 or something.
Not really compared to some other models. Some people infer more than 1,000, a factor of 1,000.
Uh-huh.
But I think that's because they do not have the cosmology really built in.
How does it depend on the cosmology? Do you have a feel of if you change the cosmological numbers by the sum within the allowed range, how will it affect the factor?
I would think if you are just perturbing around WMAP5, it shouldn't matter much because most of this evolution is inferred from the from this the source count and also the luminosity function. I think there's little space for even stronger evolution at very high redshift. So at redshift two, I think there is already reasonable agreement. Back to Gil's question. This is based on a patch of 1,000 square degrees only. Of course, for the current experiments, that's of the correct order. But if I run it in a more I mean, in larger area. I certainly can expect crazy points.
Right, but it really sounds like it's uncertainties in evolution that are really dominating that era out there.
Yes.
And that's what we have to know then.
Yes.
So we should probably continue. We're running out of time, so we have plenty of time afterwards to continue our discussion.
Yes. Thank you for your
patience. All right, thanks a lot.